This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Out of all the many high-ticket items the city of Bloomington could spend money on, City Council candidate Josh Barnett says one tops his list.
If we were going to put priorities together, I would say a new and improved public works facility would be pretty high on that list for me.
Barnett says he doesn't see a library project for several years. He also talks about other priorities for his council candidacy. Plus, a Boys and Girls Club volunteer serving community service was recently accused of sexually assaulting a teenage girl who's a Boys and Girls Club client. With us is the head of the club to talk about child safety and his organization's policy. And it's GLT's Grow. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Prosecutors have charged a 23-year-old man who was fulfilling his community service obligations for a domestic battery conviction by volunteering at the local Boys and Girls Club with the sexual assault of a teenage girl. Julia Scott had come to know the girl through the club, though the alleged incident did not happen as part of club activities or at the club. It's a case that has caused the club to re-examine who it allows to perform community service. Boys and Girls Club CEO Tony Morstetter joins us to talk about the situation. What happened when you learned a man under your supervision had been accused of such a crime?
Yeah, actually, our family members, one of our family members, had reached out to us, and we started working with them and gained details of the incident. So after that point, we approached the Bloomington Police Department and filed a report to begin an investigation.
Any volunteer-assisted organization that deals with kids has protocols for background checks and vetting, rules for volunteer conduct, training or briefing for volunteers. What process had the Boys and Girls Club had before this?
The Boys and Girls Club... We have volunteers that support us on a daily basis. Volunteers come in and speak to us about their interest, and we have them fill out a background check waiver as well as a mentor application. There's various tasks, duties that our volunteers do for us, and so we want to get that background information from them as well as run that background check prior to them volunteering at the Boys and Girls Club.
And training and oversight?
Yes. So all of our volunteers are required to go through a volunteer orientation. And through that volunteer orientation, we cover our operations manual, our employee handbook, and the different guidelines and policies that we have in place.
And what are the policies and guidelines for interacting with kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So I know that's the fun part of our job, working with the kids. But any volunteers or interns that volunteer at the Boys and Girls Club or help us out, they're assistance to our program staff. They're never to be in a one-on-one situation with our members. And we don't want our employees to be in a one-on-one situation with our members either. So it's a volunteer, an intern, multiple staff, in the presence of our minors or our members.
This may be beyond what you can say because of a pending legal case, but how did it come to be that this person allegedly went on to have a one-on-one outside of the confines of the Boys and Girls Club?
Yeah, I'm not sure about those specifics.
How had the, until this incident, how had your policies and procedures been working out? Obviously, everybody has hiccups or bumps, and you have to take action to say, okay, you can't come back or whatever. But how many incidents or serious incidents or little warning signs had you dealt with over the last few years?
To be honest with you, none that I can remember.
Worked pretty well then.
Yeah.
So what are the benefits of having people who are doing community service do work for you?
Yes. You know, as a nonprofit organization, and, you know, I don't want to speak about others, but I know that we have challenges. You know, there's budgetary, financial constraints. We would love to have a robust staff. We have many volunteers that help us out through the year, and it provides an additional opportunity for our kids to connect with others, you know, on various levels. You know, many of our volunteers come in and help do other things as well, and not necessarily supervise or be in the presence of our members.
What had Julia Scott been doing for you?
I believe at the time he was working as a support person, a volunteer, and kind of being part of or in the presence of, you know, our program.
Since the alleged sexual assault, you have said the club will no longer take people convicted of crimes as volunteers. How many people rendering court-ordered community service had you typically used?
It's hard to say. You know, I would say on average, maybe 15 a quarter, 20 a semester. It really varied. And we had a great relationship with the court services, and we still do, and they understand the situation. But we've asked that we be removed from that court-ordered community service list.
What else is in the new policy?
I'll be honest with you, there's not much that's new in the policy. You know, it's a matter of just monitoring what we're doing, making sure that the policies that we have in place are enforced. And one thing that we did change is we've centralized the volunteer process. So in the past, you know, volunteers would report to individual supervisors of programs. Now we have a director of operations. She and I handle all the volunteers that come in and request to do volunteer or internships with the Boys and Girls Club.
Will the change in not allowing community service people in, all people convicted of something, also affect other volunteers not doing court-ordered community service who may have been convicted of something in the past?
I'm sure it'll have an impact. We've actually had others come in and ask if there's volunteer opportunities for them, and we've referred them to other agencies that don't work with youth.
So does the new policy differentiate between those who have a history of violence, as it appears the suspect in this case did, or someone whose criminal history might involve something nonviolent or not connected to one's own emotional regulation and ability to abide by boundaries?
Yeah, again, you know, I don't know that there's much change with the policy. It's just a matter of making sure that, you know, us centralizing that process and going through, you know, one person, that we can monitor that and make sure that those processes are abided by.
So did this guy slip through the cracks somehow?
I would say it appears to be.
Okay. How have you decided to plug that? By the centralizing the intake?
Or? Yes.
Okay. So had a background check been done on him?
I can't confirm that.
Okay. So in hindsight, it seems like there might have been protocols in place that should have kept him out?
There are.
Okay.
And there were.
In this case, the defendant's criminal record could have been found within seconds online. Do you typically use that as a checkpoint?
We do.
Okay. And have you identified the failure point in your current policies for this?
I believe we have.
What was it?
Due to the pending investigation, I don't want to speak about that. I'm sorry.
Okay. What have parents of club members been telling you since this happened?
You know, it's been amazing. You know, Bloomington Normal is an amazing community. You know, we provide services for youth in our community, but we also support our families as well. So it's been an overwhelming response and very supportive from our families.
How decentralized was your process before? How many different intakes were there for volunteers?
Yeah, it wasn't very different. You know, each of the program supervisors had an opportunity to supervise, work with our volunteers. So that's been consolidated from maybe four people to one.
This comes at a time when the club is kicking off a major fund drive for a new clubhouse in Sunnyside Park. You're looking at about $12 million for the project. Have you had questions from donors as opposed to parents?
More support. It's been amazing. Our donors, our community partners, they've been very supportive in the process. They believe in what we do. They know that we take the safety of our members, our team, our staff, and that's our number one priority is the safety.
Do you think this is a damage to the club's reputation, or is it being viewed as a one-off that can be corrected?
Yeah, I would say a little bit of both. You know, there are people in the community that are concerned, as well as we are. But we want to reassure the community that the safety of our members is our number one priority. It's always been our number one priority, and it will remain our number one priority.
As context for the public, how many total volunteers do you have in any given year, with how many interactions that have no problems, interactions with kids?
Yeah, in 2017, we tracked over 400 volunteers that helped support the Boys and Girls Club in that calendar year. And it's various things. You know, some come and hang out with the kids, play basketball. Bloomington Edge comes over. You know, they throw the football around with the young members. We have people that come in and serve meals. We have others that come in and, you know, help do tasks around the club. So, you know, 400, they could come in on a, you know, one-off basis, maybe a one-time project, and then we have people that come throughout the entire semester.
And how fast do they turn over? I mean, volunteerism, people come, people go, some stick for a long time, some people's lives change and they go. What's your ongoing demand for volunteers?
It continues to be great. The more volunteers that we have, the greater opportunities we can provide for our kids and, interns, volunteers, just additional people to come in and support the club. And it also provides us an opportunity for people to become familiar with what we do. There's been many times where our volunteers end up becoming staff or employees with the Boys and Girls Club.
How do kids benefit from these interactions?
You know, one thing that we do is we try to build positive, supportive relationships with our members, and it allows an opportunity for that, as well as it allows our members an opportunity to be exposed or learn from our volunteers.
If somebody wants to volunteer, where is that central point of access now?
They can contact me directly, or they can contact Jenny Hall. Jenny Hall's our director of operations, and we'd be happy to, sit down and speak with them and learn, kind of where their passion is, what their why is, and how they would like to support the Boys and Girls Club.
Tony Morstetter is the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Bloomington Normal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable and timely financial management with a contemporary independent perspective. Zimmerman and Armstrong have been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a report on how to keep kids safe in school, an emergency plan. That's coming up from IPR. Republican County Board Member Josh Barnett has announced his candidacy for Bloomington Alderman, serving only part of his county board term. If elected, he'll be representing Ward 8 in the city. Barnett says he wants to have more direct constituent contact and action than happens on the county board.
Right now, for instance, I get phone calls sometimes from constituents who say, hey, I've got a question about garbage pickup. I've got a complaint about bulk waste. I've got an issue with a pothole in front of my street. And more often than not, all of those questions, actually, I have to say, you know, those are city issues. And I'm happy to help connect you to the city, but really you want to contact the city staff, or you want to contact your alderman about those issues. So this would allow me to be able to maybe help out in some of those issues in a more direct way.
If elected, would you be serving the entire term, as you're not going to be serving the entire term for county board, or would you seek another office, say mayor?
Say mayor of Bloomington? I think that I would be very excited to be able to serve a full term on the city council.
Do you harbor ambitions?
I think right now what I'm focused on is running for city council and being able to serve as alderman in Ward 8. If another day down the road, another opportunity opened up, I mean, that'd be exciting and that'd be something to talk about. But right now, my passion would be serving the folks of Ward 8.
What did you pick up on county board that will be useful at the council level?
One of the great things that the county board does is it, even though it is a partisan organization, it operates very much so like it is nonpartisan. You see often with various issues that may come up, folks reaching across the aisle and working together. George Gordon, who's a dear friend of mine, he's a Democrat. He's very fond of saying that there is very rarely a partisan vote that goes down along party lines on the county board. I think that type of collaboration and working together across the aisle is what's needed at the city council. You can see that in some of the dysfunction that exists there right now. There's a need for some bridge building, I believe, on the city council.
What is the pulse of Ward 8?
I think Ward 8 generally is a more conservative area of the city. Its voters certainly are more conservative in how they vote in elections. I think that the citizens of Ward 8, it's a bit of a diverse group. It does make up some more of our legacy neighborhoods along Mercer Avenue. It also goes out to the Grove Subdivision on the far east side of Bloomington. And in the middle of that, there's a State Farm corporate headquarters as well as Eastland Mall. So it is a bit of a diverse area within the city. So there are lots of opportunities to represent some diverse groups of people within that.
You referred to dysfunction on the city council. Define that, what you see as dysfunctional, and how you would approach changing that.
Well, I think anyone who's tuned into a city council meeting, you know, in the last year or so, it's a very good chance you may have seen some aldermen or alderwomen arguing back and forth, maybe with the mayor. And it's unfortunate that those types of things have happened. I would hope that because of the good relationships I have with folks on the council right now, that I would be able to be a bridge builder and to help move the city forward in some of those areas where there's been issues and problems.
All public servants start with the good intention of serving and getting along with their fellow office holders. What do you think went wrong despite those good intentions, and what stylistically or in a manner of communication would have to change for you to avoid falling into the same reactive, as you put it, dysfunction?
Sure. I think collaboration and being able to work with people whose views you may not necessarily share or agree with comes first and foremost from understanding them as a person, as a human being, and being able to sit down and have coffee with them and really get to know them and get to know the issues that they're passionate about and why it is that they care about those issues and why they have the viewpoint that they do.
Is there a particular problem center on the council that creates the dysfunction or creates the breakdown in relationships?
I don't think so. I think everyone shares a little bit of the responsibility of that. Every single person in that council is elected to not only serve their ward, but to serve the city as a whole and all of its citizens, and they all bear responsibility for that. I would hope that I would be able to, you know, come on board and work with some of those folks who are there to be able to make a positive difference and hopefully help change the climate of the council.
For instance, Alderman Jamie Mathey recently remarked in an interview with GLT that perhaps the reason the welcoming city ordinance meeting was canceled was that relationships had broken down because of the way the mayor called the meeting. He didn't call it as a committee of the whole where it could be discussed. He called a special meeting and said, I'm calling this meeting. It's not a collaborative thing. I'm calling it. Is that an example of what you're talking about?
Well, you know, I don't agree with the mayor on everything that he does or everything that he says, and I think that probably could be true for a lot of people. But he and I certainly have a mutual respect for one another. I hope that when there are issues like that that come up, that I would be able to be a bridge builder between the council members and between the mayor to try to resolve some of those issues.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Josh Barnett, who is announcing his candidacy for alderman of the city of Bloomington. He's currently a county board member. Does the council or does the city devote enough attention to downtown Bloomington? Some planners say that as your core goes, so goes the city. Others have begun to say, you know, we've spent an awful lot of time and resources on downtown. What about the rest of the wards, the rest of the city? Where do you fall in that continuum?
Well, I don't think that you can allow any neighborhood or any section of your city to fall behind, and that includes downtown Bloomington. Downtown Bloomington is the core of the city. It's the heart of the city, and we should do all that we can to make sure that it is as successful as possible. You know, no one comes to visit a community and goes home and tells folks about how nice the Walmart is there. Right. When you go to a community like, let's say, Naperville or St. Charles, and you experience their downtown and what they have to offer, you go home and you tell family and friends about that, and they want to go and visit themselves and check it out. That's what causes businesses to want to locate in a downtown area. I believe long term, the answer to a lot of downtown Bloomington struggles is having businesses locate in the downtown area. And I don't mean retail. I mean folks who are there Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, working each and every single day. Those folks will eat at the restaurants in downtown Bloomington. They'll go out for happy hours afterwards at the establishments. They'll shop in the stores that are in downtown. And eventually, that will raise the need for housing in the downtown area. I think long-term, that is one of the main drivers to help fix the downtown problem.
What is the city currently doing that is on point for that particular bring working businesses, not shopping, but working businesses downtown? And what is lacking that you think ought to be done?
I don't think that the city is doing much in that area right now. I believe that the city should be actively recruiting either businesses that are currently within Bloomington to consider locating in the downtown area, or reaching out into other communities to try to recruit businesses to come in the area.
Well, the community already has this community development arm of city government. There's BNBiz, there's the EDC. All of those are pointed toward bringing in business to certain parts of the community. City of Bloomington apparatus just included, folded in the Downtown Bloomington Association.
Right.
What do you mean it's not doing anything?
Well, I think if the city was being successful and was focused on bringing businesses into downtown, I think that we would see some of those results happening right now. And I haven't seen results like that.
Define success, then. Define what sort of outreach or what sort of process needs to be changed to eventually develop results.
Yeah, well, I think we could look to our neighbors to the north in the town of Normal. You know, Farnsworth Group is looking at consolidating their offices and building a new building in Uptown Normal. I think that is a prime example of what can and should happen in downtown Bloomington.
Yeah, but define how they should be going about it that they're not now doing.
I think it starts with staff and also, aldermen in concert with staff, reaching out to businesses, identifying a list of potential prospects that you could reach out to and have those discussions with. And some of those folks you're going to go to, and they're going to say, you know, no, we're perfectly happy where we are right now. But, you know, you may get someone to bite and say, yeah, I'd be interested in moving my 25 or my 50 employees into a facility in downtown Bloomington. And let's talk about that. Let's explore that and see what the opportunity looks like.
We just referred to a whole bunch of economic development entities that are focused on that issue. Do you think that those are coordinating well enough across Bloomington Normal?
I think that there could be improvements there for how they're coordinating and how they're working so that we're not doubling down on efforts or stepping on one another's toes. I think that the Economic Development Council is well positioned as the overarching agency to help lead the efforts in that. And once they get a new CEO in, I mean, I'd certainly be happy to work with that person to try to move that effort forward.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Josh Barnett is announcing his candidacy for alderman in Ward 8 of the city of Bloomington in 2019. What other major issues do you see facing your ward and the city at large?
Well, you know, I believe as an alderman, you need to take care of your ward, but you also need to have a holistic view of the city as a whole. You know, as an alderman for Ward 8, I'll certainly represent my constituents when it comes to helping to identify needs for police and fire, streets and sewers, parks, some of those basic needs within the city. But as a as an alderman, I'd also would have that holistic view. I would certainly want to champion economic development like we talked about. I'd want to work with the police force to see what we can do to address crime issues in no matter what area they may be within the city.
Can the city afford a new library and a capstone project in downtown Bloomington? Or what other any other big-ticket item you'd care to name, say, a multi-sport complex?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I believe what the city needs to do is about a year or so ago, they came out with a capital improvement list of all these different needs that were out there, and the library was among them, and there were lots of things listed on there. A new recreation facility was another one. I think that the city council needs to sit down and have some thoughtful discussion and prioritize that list. To my knowledge, that has not happened yet. That way, when something like a sports complex comes up, we say, okay, well, where does that fall within our priority list? Where is the importance of that? You know, right now, I'll give you a great example of what I believe is a high priority for the city. Right now, our public works facility. Public works employees are responsible partially for maintaining and working on our fire trucks when they break down or they have an issue of some kind. The fire trucks are too large to fit inside our public works facility. That means if it's February and it's snowing and it's -5 degrees with a wind chill, and it's 10 o'clock at night, public works employees are outside, for the most part, working on that fire truck to get it back in service. Now, I believe that's a disservice to public works employees. It's a disservice to the fire department and all the people in Bloomington Normal who depend on those services. If we were going to put priorities together, I would say a new and improved public works facility would be pretty high on that list for me.
That also would assist what the library says it wants, which is expansion at its current site.
Right.
Which is now partly held by Public Works.
Yeah.
So how much will that cost, and what sort of timeline do you think is affordable for the city to move Public Works?
Yeah, well, I believe Jim Karch, who's the director of Public Works for the city, has tossed out a figure of about $7 to $12 million, somewhere in that ballpark, if I'm remembering that right. It's been a few months since I've heard him talk about that. Can the city afford to sit down and do that right now? I mean, maybe not, but it certainly is something that I think we should have prioritized on our list to know when we get to the point where we can't afford an investment like that, when can we pull the trigger on that?
So if you don't think we can afford an immediate $7 to $12 million, because it's well known that the city of Bloomington is going to be facing another tough budget year, and the library is 3 to 4 times that $7 to $12 million. How far off is a new library, in your opinion? 20 years?
I think that a new library is probably a ways off. I don't know that I would say 20 years, but it's certainly, I don't think right now rises to the top of the highest priority list for the city. I think that the library building that we have certainly needs some work. I know that the library director has said that I think it needs like about $2 million of work to be able to maintain the current building. The roof has issues. There's some other problems with that building. But a brand new facility or a significant expansion of that facility, I think it's a ways off. And I don't really know that there is a palette within the council right now to fund a library at that level over some of the other needs that the city has.
As we just alluded, it's going to be another tough budget year. A lot of the low-hanging fruit has already been addressed in terms of cutting, in terms of reprioritizing, in terms of raising some of the fees out there. What would your metrics be for structuring the discussion for the next tough budget year?
Yeah, well, I think you need to start with basic needs and work your way out from there. You know, long term, we are not going to be able to cut our way out of the current budget needs that the city has. We're also not going to be able to tax our way out of that. Part of the reason that this city has blossomed and done so well since the, I don't know, the late 50s, mid 60s, up until maybe the 2010s, somewhere around in there, in the mid 2010s, is because of the tremendous economic growth that happened within the community. Now, a lot of that was because of State Farm, but there are other entities that caused that to happen as well. I believe when we are looking toward fixing long-term budget issues, that comes from generating new economic growth within the community, bringing new businesses here, encouraging entrepreneurial spirit to happen within Bloomington Normal, and building out new small and medium-sized businesses to employ folks, to give jobs, and to help boost the tax base. The EAV within Bloomington has been flat for the past couple of years. I think that, if that starts to go down, then it's really going to be cause for concern. We want that EAV to go up and to show that the economy is doing well and is healthy and growing. And that's only going to happen if we have new jobs coming to this community, and not just retail jobs, jobs that can pay a mortgage, that can allow folks to raise a family, purchase a car, and all those things that all of us like to do each and every single day. And that's going to take hard work. It's going to take long-term vision and planning for the city. But I think that we can do it. I mean, Bloomington, this is an amazing place to live. Bloomington, in my opinion, is the premier city. We're certainly the premier metro area in all of downstate Illinois. That's why I live here. That's why my wife lives here with me. That's why we're raising our son here, because this is such a great place to live. And I think that if we go out and we sell that across companies may be interested in relocating, and we go out and start recruiting some of those folks, I think we can really have some good wins here in Bloomington. We've already seen some of that demonstrated with Brandt coming into the community and relocating here. Of course, that's not specifically within the city of Bloomington, but still, it certainly is a win for the community as a whole. Long term, wins like that are what is going to solve the city's budget issues.
Josh Barnett, 8th Ward candidate for alderman in the city of Bloomington, the seat currently being held by Diana Hellman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie. Appreciate the time.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
With midterm elections around the corner, keeping up with the headlines this political season can seem like a chore.
Democrats need 23 seats on net to take back control of Congress.
A teacher has defeated the Kentucky State House majority leader in the Republican primary.
All Things Considered gives you the context and analysis and news you need without all the noise. Hear the bigger picture every afternoon.
I'm GLT All Things Considered host Mike McCurdy. Join me weekdays from 3 to 6 p.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, announcing British royalty romance and tomfoolery this year's summer season. The hilarious Merry Wives of Windsor, heroic Henry V, and witty romantic Shakespeare in Love run July through early August. Tickets at IllinoisShakes.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Still to come on GLT Sound Ideas, another report on the money machine in Illinois politics. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. The U.S. Secret Service released a guide this month to help prevent school violence. Illinois has a very similar plan in the works. Months ago it began. IPR's Dusty Rhodes got a copy of it.
The school safety plan comes from the Illinois Terrorism Task Force. Its chairman, Mike Chamness, convened a working group just a couple of weeks after the school shooting rampage in Parkland, Florida.
We were looking for recommendations that avoided getting into the political quagmire of gun control and things like that, but practical recommendations that incrementally might make schools safer.
Take, for example, recommendation number 12. It suggests that school buildings with sprinkler systems could use a two-step fire alarm. After the initial alarm, staff would have up to 3 minutes to assess whether there's really a fire or a shooter trying to lure students out of classrooms.
We recommended that that's something that districts and fire chiefs should take a look at and consider protocols, because the world has changed in terms of you pull a fire alarm and you immediately evacuate a building. Now, it might not be the best thing to do.
That's a pretty novel idea. But Illinois' 13-point plan mainly focuses on more conventional measures, such as establishing behavioral threat assessment teams, which is also the linchpin of the Secret Service guidelines. The federal version says these teams should include an interdisciplinary group of teachers, counselors, coaches, school resource officers, and administrators. The Illinois version specifies law enforcement officers, mental health professionals, and other disciplines as needed. Such teams were mandated for colleges and universities more than a decade ago. In response to a shooting spree at Virginia Tech in which 27 students and 5 faculty members were killed. Jansen Eddington serves on the threat assessment team at the University of Illinois Springfield, where he's the acting dean of students.
Well, we have 2 teams at the university. We have the campus behavioral intervention team, and then we also have a separate threat assessment team.
That first team, which he calls CBIT, was formed in 2006, a year before the Virginia Tech massacre. Comprised of administrators and professors, part of its mission is to assist students in crisis by hooking them up with appropriate campus services, like counseling, academic support, social connections, before their personal crisis grows into something larger.
CBIT tries to put out a fire before it starts, is how I maybe would describe it.
The threat assessment team handles actual threats. The 2 teams share some of the same staff members, such as the campus police chief, but he doesn't lead either team.
The chief, he participates, advises, gives support, but these are not directed from a law enforcement perspective.
The plan Mike Chamness and his group have drafted for K-12 schools is mostly from a law enforcement perspective. Of its 22 members, all but 2 of whom are male, roughly half have law enforcement backgrounds, while only 6 members have any history of direct experience in K-12 education. Their plan emphasizes making school buildings more secure, setting up portals for students to report concerns about classmates anonymously, and sharing relevant tips with the behavioral threat assessment team. Chamness says this should be interpreted as a recommendation to provide services.
The intent of that is not to suspend, expel, or arrest. So in our mind, that clearly is a recommendation to identify and get help to students in need.
He suggests amending laws that govern how schools can use certain tax levies to let districts access that money to hire mental health professionals. But what Jansen Eddington has learned in 12 years of working with college students is that there's no easy way to predict which students are in crisis.
Sometimes students who we talk about in CBIT are the students that have not made many connections. Sometimes they aren't. Sometimes they're students that we've all had some interaction with, and, you know, students can be in crisis in any level of social interaction.
The governor's public safety working group is not open to the media. Chamness says his school safety working group has always been open. Each meeting is posted on his office building's front door. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Spending continues to climb in the Illinois governor's race, which could become the most expensive gubernatorial election in modern U.S. history. Incumbent Governor Bruce Rauner and challenger J.B. Pritzker are not just filling their own campaign coffers, they're also funding down-ballot races. In the latest in our election year series, Money Magazine's IPR's Mary Hansen explains.
Last fall, J.B. Pritzker spoke to reporters after getting the nod from the Illinois Democratic County chairs in Springfield. He told the crowd what his campaign was about.
It's a lot about beating Bruce Rauner. But it isn't just about beating Bruce Rauner. It's about electing every Democrat everywhere in this state.
It's pretty standard rhetoric for a gubernatorial hopeful looking to win the party's nomination, which he did several months later. For previous candidates, that approach may have meant coordinating events, fundraising and messages, maybe even sharing donors. But for Pritzker, it's also meant giving money, a lot of money. Since last May, the billionaire hotelier has donated more than $5 million to Democratic Party funds, controlled by House Speaker Michael Madigan and other party leaders. This may sound familiar, a wealthy gubernatorial candidate handing out millions in campaign money to party leaders for down-ballot races. Near-billionaire Governor Bruce Rauner, with the help of some wealthy friends, has flooded Republican races with cash since he first ran in 2014. Brendan O'Sullivan is a Democratic strategist and fundraiser in Illinois. He remembers one massive donation in particular.
Governor Rauner wrote a $9 million check to the Republicans, and it was early October of 2016. The additional $9 million being spent in those elections was deflating, to say the least.
O'Sullivan and other Democratic operatives on the opposite side of that $9 million had to figure out how to match it. Democrats have accused Rauner of using this money to intimidate lawmakers into following his agenda, which the governor denies. And there are some key differences between Rauner's and Pritzker's contributions and their potential influence on lawmakers. For one thing, there's not a power vacuum atop the Democratic Party. Speaker Madigan retains a firm grip, and Democrats have majorities in both chambers of the General Assembly. This leaves less room for a wealthy donor to come in and assert influence. O'Sullivan sees the advantages of having a wealthy donor at the top of the ticket.
I think there's a sense of relief that, okay, we have someone who can help us match Governor Rauner.
But there are some concerns with this tit-for-tat strategy. Mary Miro is the executive director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, a good government group in Chicago. She worries this funding from above means less reliance on local fundraising for candidates. When you get money from neighbors, businesses, or other groups,
it's a shared prioritization, right, of your community, of your district, in terms of getting you in that legislative seat to make the changes that your community, your constituents, really feel is vital.
If candidates don't need that support as much,
you can excel and you can potentially ascend to that seat without the support of your constituents directly.
Miro says it can also shut out potential candidates who don't have those connections to traditional political parties. And in Illinois, those political parties have always had a big influence, as Brian Gaines, a political scientist with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, explains.
It's still true that party leaders have exaggerated or influence on the election campaigns because they control the purse strings.
This was true when Illinois didn't have many campaign funding rules, when it was considered the Wild West of election spending. After Governor Rod Blagojevich attempted to sell President Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat, lawmakers put in some reforms.
At the time, they were described by some as sweeping campaign finance reform. It was going to change the way everything was done in Illinois. The thing they didn't change that was probably the most distinctive thing about Illinois was that the parties can still funnel money wherever they like.
So wealthy candidates and donors give millions to the parties, which they then turn around and distribute to the most competitive races. But Gaines says the way the legislative district maps are drawn means there are very few competitive races where Republicans are just as likely to win as Democrats. So what you get is a handful of hyper-expensive campaigns. Kane says to make elections fair, changing how districts are drawn may be just as important as changing campaign funding rules. I'm Mary Hansen.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There are myriad pests ready to attack your vegetable garden and landscaping, and some attack in a group. In this edition of our gardening program, Grow, GLT's Mike McCurdy talks with Patrick Murphy about how to control worms that attack as an army.
Your lawn could be under attack from an army. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Hey, Murph, how are you?
Good day, Mike. How are you?
Good. And we have a question from a GLT listener and a Grow listener, Kathy Sully of Bloomington, Illinois, about a pest.
Late in the afternoon, saw a lot of, I would describe them as little brown worms, or maybe more like caterpillars, skinny, most of them being probably 2 inches long, but gosh, you know, maybe at least 100 on the back patio, which was a lot. I mean, a lot.
On a neighborhood social media site, some posted about army worms, and she's pretty sure that's what she ended up, what ended up causing big brown patches as early as the next day. Murph, tell me about army worms.
Army worms are a group of worms, actually, because there's a, you know, group of, say, like three worms, the cutworm, the cornworm, and the army worm. They are all kind of from the same group.
So everybody sort of calls these three worms an army worm.
Yeah, and any of the three can show up in any of the places similar to the caller's question, right? So they're called army worms because oftentimes when they're encountered, they're seen in big groups all going in one direction, kind of like they're marching. So that's why they're called army worm, and they are from a moth. It's a larval stage of a moth.
So Kathy said she saw a lot of moths earlier in the summer before seeing the arrival of the worms. That could have been when the eggs were laid?
I think that's really the only way, because when you were planning the show, Mike, there was some discussion with the caller and myself about possibly having them come in a pot full of field soil or something like that. That's a possibility, too.
Well, I asked her about that, and here's what she had to say.
No, we had not, and I'm not aware that our neighbors next door to us, behind us, hadn't seen anything like that with the neighbors. So I would say no.
Then it looks like it was the moth.
So right? You think it was the moth then?
Airborne, it could have flown in from a field or a plot nearby.
So tell me about the life cycle of this worm. Are they harmful, more harmful at certain points in their life cycle than they are at other points? I assume the moth isn't doing damage.
They do have, the moths are kind of, at that point, they become bird food, right? And their only hazard is they're laying eggs for more larvae. But the armyworm in its early days, which would be during wet, cool periods in the early growing season, so that's mid to late spring, early spring is too cold for them, but what happens is the egg is it's there and it can hatch, and the moth can lay as many as 8 bundles of eggs, you know, and over a period of time. So these eggs are hatching continuously throughout the growing season, almost into the heat of the summer. In the early days, in the larval stage, the armyworm is feeding close to the ground, and that's when some of the other names come to play, like cutworm, and they're feeding on the plant where it emerges from the ground. So then it's interrupting relocation of nutrients, photosynthesis, and all those things. That's why the armyworm can show stress in turf. But later on in its life, shortly after that ground feeding phase, it goes into eating the leaves of various crops, cabbage, corn, all different kinds, and has the little cutting mouth part on it so it can bore down and make like galleries in an ear of corn. Mm.
So they're also known as cutworms. Is that because they're working close to the ground and cut the grass or the vegetation off right at the ground, or is that because of the cutting mechanism on their mouth?
I say it's either, because I don't know for sure what the,
either,
there's
either,
a lot of there's a lot of
works.
Naming a lot of rights that go into naming stuff, right? So, but they do have that cutting mouth part, so that could easily be the reason why.
There are a lot of them. That's how they get their name, an army worm. Is it easy to imagine that the next day you could start seeing brown patches as these worms sort of march through your turf?
I think that that's a reasonable outcome, because right now we're at the part of the growing season where in between the much-needed rains, it's hot, and any little setback, particularly in turf, it can be noticeable in a day, especially if you're someone that's paying attention. You can see that little browning, and the browning will occur in patches where the worms are located.
How can a homeowner control these worms? The Sullys had a lawn service. They couldn't get there in time, at least not quickly enough for them to get rid of these worms, which sort of left her with a huge ick factor when she saw all these worms on her patio. So they went out and bought a commercially available pesticide.
Okay.
So I assume that's one way you could get rid of them.
That's one way to do it. And the IPM strategy that we talk about a lot, Mike, the use of synthetic chemicals is the last line of defense if you've tried other things, or if you need to substitute time with money, you know, if you don't have the ability to use the BT or the milky spore, because that takes about 3 years for it to build up in your soil and be taken up by plants. That's one step. There's also pheromone traps and predator wasps that are biological controls. Admittedly, these are difficult to use outdoors.
So pheromone traps, that won't attract more of the pest to your yard?
Well,
I mean, that's why I don't use them with Japanese beetles.
That's exactly the point. That's an excellent point you bring up. So the Japanese beetles, they're a new pest, and that's the unintended outcome of setting up the traps, is that you attract every Japanese beetle in the county to your property,
you
and they're flying.
Flying. You should put the pheromone traps in your neighbor's yards.
Right. You know, or out in the middle of the wilderness on the edge of the county would be a great spot, too, and that's something that the government could give us a hand with, actually. But the pheromone traps for the armyworms, the pheromones are specific usually, so they don't attract needed pollinators and other beneficials. But pheromone traps, they don't last long when they're exposed to full sunlight and the little bit of dew in the morning or the water from irrigation or whatever. That makes them break down quickly.
So what would you do to control the armyworm or eliminate it?
I think I would go with the horticultural oil alternative of neem oil. Neem oil is a botanical extract from a type of tree.
Can you spell that?
N-E-E-M. And I've seen it spelled with a G on the front of it before on packaging, but I'm pretty certain that N-E-E-M is the best spelling for that one. But it is something that will affect the various stages. So if you happen to be spraying where you see the army worms, you don't want to spray everything. You want to spray just where you're seeing the worms. It's likely that the neem oil will have a negative effect on any eggs that are there too. That sometimes that's something that the synthetic pesticides can miss out on. But the neem oil is something that's inexpensive. It's easy to spray. Some people find the odor offensive. Other people find it to be quite pleasant. So it's a preference and taste thing. But PPE is limited in requirements as far as spraying this. You mix it with water and spray it through a handheld sprayer for the greatest control. It's a great way to go. The ladybugs that we encounter here during the harvest time, they are good predators, but it's a little late in the game at that point. So around harvest time, those army worms are reaching their final molt and they're becoming moths and they're laying eggs for the next year.
And you said there was a wasp, a predator wasp, that could also help control these worms. Is that something you buy or something that, because I've done this before, I've planted a beneficial insect garden before that attracts those kinds of wasps that then attack worms and larvae and cutworms, things like that.
Yeah.
And that would be a longer process, but can you just go buy the wasp?
You can. You can buy the wasps. You can buy the lace wings. You can buy the ladybugs. All of these things, you could buy them.
Locally or mail order?
Mail order is the best way to get them through a horticultural supplier like Hummert or A.M. Leonard. That would be a great place to find those.
Okay, Murph, if you have any questions about army worms or other pests, you can submit them, like Kathy Sally did, at wglt.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about sod, removing sod, and why that might be a great route for you. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Hear this and other past episodes of Grow at our wglt.org website. Our website is also where you can subscribe to the Grow podcast. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and Mike McCurdy. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.